just going to your report, the 42A report. On page 6, paragraph, section 6.6, the second bullet point. Down the very end there, the landscape character of these areas and the management of them with regard to subdivision and development do not benefit from the existing visual landscape amenity provisions. Could you just expand on why you think that that's the case?
Visual amenity landscape provisions focus on mitigating the impacts of buildings in the rural area. My view on them is that they don't have sufficient regard to the character that a landscape might have in its own right. What I mean by that is that it encourages a settlement pattern that includes planting that would be more akin to clustering. Perhaps the scenario could be a clustering of vegetation around the proposed development, or what will become the development node. Whereas large parts of the rural zone have a vegetation pattern that is influenced for sheltering stock through pastoral farming, through sheltering stock. So the visual amenity landscape provisions encourage, or if they don't encourage, they certainly are not adverse to modifications to the landscape from the establishment of clusters of vegetation, where perhaps a better development response, or sorry, a better design response, could actually be linear planting. Now, there's conflicting policies and assessment matters that would need to be reconciled in both the operative and proposed plans, because there are provisions that discourage linear planting where that doesn't suit the character. So the provisions discourage planting of a shelter belt, especially along a road boundary, and in 10 years' time somebody could justify that you can't, the development would be screened. What's happened though is that you've lost your view of the landscape, whether it be a relatively close view of the immediate landscape or a much wider view of the outstanding natural landscape. It could be 10 kilometres away, part of a mountain range. But at the same, but while trying to reconcile that, there is a policy that encourages planting to suit the character, and that's quite a different policy to what you'd see in the existing visual amenity landscape.
In your response just then, you said that there are policies that encourage that in the ODP and the PDP.
I said there were policies that discourage linear planting in the operative plan and the proposed plan.
Right.
But what the proposed plan is trying to do, so in light of what I just explained to you in that situation, what the proposed plan does is recognise or require an assessment of the character in its own right, and there could be instances where linear planting is more appropriate than, say, clustered planting, because that would suit the established pattern of vegetation.
And say there are policies, are they policies or are they assessment criteria?
The assessment, well, I'm not going to dive into the assessment criteria, sir, because it's not part of this hearing stream. But there is a policy.
But there is actual...
There will be,
there are actual policies.
There is a policy. Right. The policy is fresh in my mind relative to the assessment matters right now. Okay, so policy 6354 under the rural landscape areas says encourage any landscaping to be sustainable and consistent with the established character of the area. So I won't trawl through the visual amenity landscape policy or assessment criteria in the operative plan, but...
No, that's fine.
I'm quite certain that the emphasis on Arcadian and pastoral and the poetic sense landscape means that that sort of clustering is...
If I could just interrupt Commissioner Sinclair, while you've got that policy fresh in your mind, what does sustainable mean in that context? Because obviously in the RMA, sustainable management is the lodestar, as some people have called it, and it has a very broad meaning. What's sustainable in that context?
It's there in the context of the climate of this district. So it's there to encourage plants that don't necessarily be water dependent, that's sustainable. So in this context, the word sustainable is narrow to the type of vegetation you might plant that would be sustainable. So it'd be hardy plants that can suit this climate and that aren't water dependent.
So viable might be a better way to describe it. Or physically sustainable.
It would give more specificity to it, I agree.
Climatically viable, yeah.
But that will change.
Thank you.
In paragraph 910 on page 9, just the last sentence there, where you consider it the PDP to be better framed, structured, which is an improvement on the ODP being more concise, direct, and providing specificity for activities in the zone. What I'm trying to get a sense of is how is the PDP actually more concise, direct, and specific? And if you want to use examples, that's fine, just comparing one to the other.
Starting at a high level, the district's landscapes will be identified. So you can take away the mystery of needing to determine what landscape classification a development site or a development might be in before you commence your assessment under the provisions in the operative plan and in the policy. Policies in the landscape chapter are more focused on an outcome sought, and they're distinct from the assessment method. assessment matters in the proposed plan focus on the adverse effects by requiring an appraisal of the quality, the character, and the visual amenity values, for an example. The policies, in turn, in the proposed plan ask consideration of how, whether or not if the development accords with that based on that. What I think the operative plan fails to do is provide a separation between the assessment matters and the policies. The things, the matters or the tests or thresholds in those policies that you need to contemplate are too similar. In terms of the treatment of a particular application in a specific area, I'm of the view that the assessment matters have been, well, we can't talk directly to them at the moment, I think the assessment matters have been ordered and structured to be a lot more specific and to avoid duplication and repetition. And I think that in turn would makes more efficient processing. The chapter as well is a lot more efficient at providing confirmation of what's in and what's out. Having reviewed some of the evidence, I think this still can be minor modifications made to the rules or the provisions section in the landscape chapter. But fundamentally, while it seems obvious, my experience with processing resource consents is that people, even planners, you know, council planners administering the plan, and lay people aren't certain if they need to apply these assessment matters for what type of activity, for a controlled activity, or restricted discretionary activity, even though the discretion is restricted. Because in turn, the assessment matters behind the ODP, landscape assessment matters, are very broad as well, and that certainty is not there. The proposed plan, without diving into the rural chapters, the proposed plan, I think, solves this by, well, for one, the landscape chapter specifies where the assessment matters apply. Then, in the rules themselves, if you have a controlled activity or a restricted discretionary activity, in nearly all instances, the matters of discretion or control are listed in the rule. So to me, you don't need to go any further than that rule if you're looking for assessment matters. I think that takes away a large part of the mystery associated with the operative district plans, rural general zone. It's easy, the more complex or contentious larger development is, the easier it is to actually apply with the ODP because you know that everything's up for grabs. But it's the smaller sort of applications that you can get where you're not quite sure how to administer it landscape assessment matters or the other assessment matters in the plan. And I see that as a risk in terms of consistent and confident administration in the plan and a risk to the council and its reputation in terms of the risk of judicial review, and it's an inefficiency in terms of how far the council officers need to go, even though if you're processing a resource consent application, you can distill it down to a few key items and you'd be comfortable processing them, but the risk of judicial review, does that force you to undertake a relatively arbitrary assessment against a whole lot of other things? Well, that's the mystery that we're trying to remove by having the structure and the provisions in the landscape chapters.
is that reflected in the, roughly what you just said, sounds like a Section 32 analysis almost, is that reflected in the 32 report?
Absolutely, it is issue one,
landscapes. I'll rephrase that, how is it reflected in the...
Issue one is, the Section 32 is categorised by issue, broad issue. Issue one is the management of the district's landscapes. Issue two, management of farming activities. Issue three is, I've identified yesterday as efficient resource, efficient, effective and efficient resource management. I think they're articulated, I think those issues are articulated through the Section 32, particularly through those, through issues one and issues three.
At the risk of sounding like a parrot, is the information that's coming that relates to the rural provisions in terms of the quantification in regard to Section 32.2, does that include this part of the plan? Is that included within that work?
Before I can promise you that any further information or amendments to the Section 32 are coming, I need to seek direction from my legal counsel. I have undertaken a cost-benefit analysis for a lot of the rules, but not all of them.
Yep.
So we'll be having a conversation internally about whether or not if we need to update any information. And I think that if it's obvious that you think that the panel think we need to, then I think some guidance on what particular aspects would be helpful. There are a lot of rules. The cost-benefit analysis in Section 32 identifies rules which are covered broadly under the cost-benefit analysis or the evaluation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think more specificity is required, I'd appreciate some guidance from the panel as to what rules, because there's a lot of rules in the proposed plan that have been rolled over from the operative plan. And it might not be the best use of resources to provide that for existing rules that aren't contested.
So, I can answer that question now if that would assist. In terms of the work that Mr. Winchester was referring to yesterday and on Monday, that is in regards to the rural hearing. So the economic work that has been commissioned, that's for the next round of hearings, this one. But your points have certainly been taken on board.
Without discussing it with my colleagues, of course, it just seems that if this is a large, that landscape's a large focus, and it seems to be related, from what I'm hearing, quite significantly to the rural chapter, that it's, and the connection that this provides through to that, it might be sufficiently covered in the existing 32, but report. Okay. Mr. Chair, the remainder of my questions are more in the actual wording within the chapter itself, so I thought maybe we'll come back to that.
Yes. Just carry on from the previous questions or series of questions we were talking about the landscaping, etc., being consistent with the character of the area. It seems to me that there's been a theme through the rural landscape category, both from your report and from the submissions, that there are almost two different areas being dealt with. Would that be a fair appraisal? And I mean different types of character.
extent, it's my view that this submission's overplaying the identification of upper mid land use in the rural zone, which just happens to contain the districts.
Well, I was thinking in terms of the issue of openness in particular. I just wondered whether it was your view that there are areas of the rural landscape classification that are open, and there are other parts of the same classification where the character is not open.
Would you like any physical examples?
I'm just wondering if you agree that that is the situation.
There certainly are. There's areas where the settlement pattern has been for a long time isn't open.
Mm.
And there's areas that since around 1995 have become confined and will continue to become confined, especially when the vegetation that was planted either through a consenting regime or just because more people live in a certain area now, that will continue to change.
One of the things that's puzzling me is whether given that disparity, it might not be sensible to split into two separate, if not categories, zones or something. I'm just wondering whether the panel might be faced with having to write something which cannot be specific enough because we're trying to cover two extremes in the same set of objectives and policies. Whether there might be another solution.
At a starting point, there's two things I'd like to raise. The first one is Dr. Reed's report. If we're talking about Waikato Basin compared to the rest of the rural areas, so there's Dr. Reed's landscape characterisation report, which is appended to the section 32. The other issue is the policies in the within the rural landscape category. There is a discussion on Dr. Reed's report and her recommendations in issue 1 of the section 32. Dr. Reed's brief for that report was tell us about the landscape character units of the basin. Do you think there should be a minimum lot size imposed? Do you think it should be a new zone? Her findings were, given the variable nature of the landscape units within the Waikato Basin, I understand she identified 24. Given that in many areas, still is proposed to be zoned rural, so not just the areas that have been identified as rural lifestyle in the proposed plan, the density was around 4 hectares.
You mean one dwelling?
One dwelling.
Per four hectares.
So if you created her advice strictly from a landscape management regime was to keep the status quo. I supported that in that context, particularly from a planning perspective, that if you create a zone, you would be looking at providing, if that's the case, then my thoughts from a planning perspective would be to provide more certainty. And once you do that, do you fall into the realm of needing to propose a minimum allotment size. So given that the basin has that variability, we consider that it was best to run with the status quo. The other issue I raised before was the policies. Without running through them blow by blow, I think that the policies, and particularly the policies within the rural landscape character, disregarding the objectives for the time being, do not overstate or do not over-egg this idea or this apparently new concept of openness. Policy 6353 is avoid planting and screening, particularly along roads and boundaries which would degrade openness, where such openness is an important part of the landscape quality or character. So proponents, so people are assessing applications, development proposals against these extra matters, we'd know after undertaking that assessment what are the important qualities of that landscape. I don't think that the policies alone in the rural landscape section create some expectation that there's going to be openness, or it's fundamental, paramount. What it's trying to do is recognise that where it is present, there's a chance that it contributes to the character, and that will overall contribute to the overall amenity and quality of that landscape. The other factor that puts me off at this point contemplating a specific zone, if you do that, you'll be acknowledging that farming as a land use, it's not so much whether or not if it's economically viable in that area, it's more a case of disregarding the formative processes that have influenced, that made that landscape what it is since the late 19th century. The policy framework contemplates other activities that rely on the rural resource, but I think that if you enabled them or provided for them, then what would be your benchmark, or what would be the sort of baselines to assess that character against, that goes back to the problems I see in the visual amenity landscape. Further to that, if you go to that level of detail and you accept that we're dealing with two different areas here, let's create a new zone. How do you do that? Do you break it down into each landscape unit? So once you've determined what those landscape units are, do you provide a policy framework for them? I see, in terms of what the district plan is trying to achieve, I see inefficiencies with that. I also think that there's a risk that no matter how good a job you do capturing the character or the qualities of each landscape unit, and then phrasing that, expressing that in policy, there's the chance that there'll be pockets of land, there'll be land holdings that are missed, and we'll be faced with the problem of the visual amenity landscape, where perhaps the policies don't quite suit a certain land holding, and it wouldn't be appropriate, so it'd be missed. There's a chance it might not be appropriately managed, and that wouldn't instill confidence in administering the plan in that landscape unit. And in a general sense, how many more policies would you need in the district plan? But it's a place with reasonably intense development pressure. So do you micromanage it?
Just looking at the policies under Objective 3635, there's quite an emphasis on avoiding planting which affects openness.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any policies that where it is not open suggests that any further development is consistent with that character?
Policy 6351 is allow subdivision and development only where it will not degrade landscape quality or character or diminish the visual amenity values identified for any rural landscape. So if you identify whatever values in that landscape,
That's in the negative rather than the positive, isn't it?
5-4.
That encourages landscaping to, conversations being had, it encourages landscaping to acknowledge what the character is and don't.
And be a type, an appropriate type.
An example, this is out of context, sir, and I was a reporting officer on it, so I'm guilty. An example, Mr. Cox might have been sitting here too. An example is, you probably drove past an example this morning, which is Monica's Triangle, which is the parcel of land bordered by Drona Valley Road, Riverbank Road and Orchard Road. So that's a paddock. It's basically a 60-hectare paddock. And it's got a resource consent for about 19 allotments, about 1 hectare each in size. They are arranged in clusters of about 3 or 4. There's a large balance area that's left. There's a generous setback from the road. It's, by all accounts, it's not a bad development, and it obtained resource consent. It wasn't appealed. The people who opposed it accepted it. But the thing I found disturbing is that the expert, landscape architect, the applicant, simply said the landscape will change from being pastoral to Arcadian, and it marched on through.
That's one side. That's dealing with an open area. What I'm more interested in is policies that deal with the other area.
I
can see that the policies are directed to maintain openness, and that's fine, but I'm also aware that a lot of submissions are from landowners who are in areas which are not open, and their concern is that they will be having openness forced on them when the policies don't seem to create a methodology for assessing applications where there is not openness. That's really what I'm getting to.
Well, I think policy, even if it's in the negative, I think policy 6351 and policy 6354 encourage it to be consistent with the established character. I'd be leaning on that if I was contemplating development in a settlement pattern that already had established amenity or Arcadian style vegetation planting with it. On the other hand, sir, the policies that identify openness and set that it is recognised. 6353, then it's got the qualifier, where such openness is an important part. And 6356, have regard to the adverse effects from subdivision development on the open landscape character where it is open and present. I don't think they're forcing openness. I think they are maintaining openness where it's important.
So where it is important is possibly the critical thing that should be in that final policy, perhaps.
It's in policy 6354. Where is open at present?
Sorry? You're talking about the being open.
Where it is important.
Yes, where the openness is important.
You'd think that it should be, if that's my view, then that should be repeated in policy 6354.
Well, I'm just wondering if you were thinking that might be an improvement.
Well, the policy says to have regard.
But what about a situation where it's open at present that the openness is unimportant to the landscape character?
Then under policy 6353, your development will accord with that. don't think it would. I don't think it would to have the word, to have the identification, you know, to include, to emphasise that it's important in policy 6356 wouldn't weaken it or underwhelm it, in my view.
Another way perhaps to do that is to have regard to the degree of adverse effects.
Is that not inherent, sir?
Not necessarily.
Okay, I'll accept that.
Doesn't 6353 have a criminally imported list or not of it? Do we have to list
only when you're, only when you're dealing with the planting and screening of long rows and boundaries.
That's particularly long rows and boundaries, not only.
No, I appreciate policy 6356 leans heavily towards, but I don't think it's absolute.
Okay, I'll leave that there.
Can I just clarify one thing, Mr. Chairman? Yes. When we're talking about the openness and that part of it, that will be identified when somebody puts lines on these maps, which is part of another hearing.
But for your benefit, for the panel's benefit, these areas identified in the, you know, within the proposed district plan rural landscape areas that have openness. I don't think those areas are contested. My experience processing resource consents, living in the district, is that, you know, there's general acceptance that those areas on the valley floor are certainly not ONL.
But that assessment has already been undertaken, will sit in the plan, so when you come to look at this, you'll know which ones are relevant and which we have to consider, particularly these policies.
Yes, sir. And I thought that...
I think what Commissioner Sinclair is wondering is whether the areas that are open will be apparent from the lines in the district.
They would be in terms of looking at the planning maps and seeing the cadastral boundaries.
Would that be always the case?
No, because...
Isn't the issue that some of the areas which are not open are not open because there's a whole series of consented that yet to be developed building platforms?
I accept that.
And you can't readily tell from either the planning maps or from the physical inspection what the degree of the openness.
I wouldn't go that far, sir. I think that you could identify areas that are open and there's no consented development on them and they are not in the ONL.
Yeah, that's the reverse that I'm concerned about. I don't think there's any problem in identifying the hardware flats are open and there's no consents.
So that's the areas where there's consented development.
It's
and it might be open now, but what's consented will mean that it won't be.
For instance, the areas south of Mulligan's Road, Plymouth Speedgrass Flat Road, those sort of areas where at present it's largely open along Mulligan Road, but I know there's quite a few consents that might alter that openness if they're going to affect it.
Well, the district plan, the proposed district plan, can't take any development rights away in terms of consented development rights.
But the point that I'm trying to get an answer to is, do these policies adequately deal with that situation as opposed to the Crown Terrace or the Harvey Flat situation? I don't have a problem that these policies have worked well for Harvey Flat.
Yeah. Well, I think... I think they do. And I think then we're starting to talk about the second suite of policies under the second objective, which is about humans and effects, and that acknowledging that there is a finite capacity. So in that context, there's and one of the contested elements of that policy suite is removing, whether or not to remove the reference to infill, so the cumulative and adverse effect from the culmination of development in infill in rural living situations.
My question also relates to just how, when you talked earlier about the landscape assessment under the ODP has to be done individually on each time there's an application. I also want to make, in terms of the openness, that's included in the parts that when you're identifying them on the maps that this is a certain landscape area, then that will direct you to be able to probably consider these policies in any application, rather than you have to do it. Is that the way it would work?
Yes. If I understand the question, yes is my answer. We can talk as we move through. Obviously, I'm not sure what you've got planned for me, but as you move through,
I'm not sure we do.
There's no plan.
No. We'll discuss the application, the administration of the sort of a scenario or the administration or an application of the rules, and you'll see in my 42A report I've responded to some submissions about how the policy should be treated, how I think the policy framework is treated in special zones, but I won't dive into that unless prompted.
Related, given the invitation, having said that you want to retain the status quo in relation to the lack of zones or compartmentalisation of the rural landscape, obviously you're doing the reverse with the O&Ls. You are moving from the status quo, which currently compartmentalises the Wakatipu Basin, and I'd invite you to explain or expand on, because of course you have explained it, the rationale, because of course in 1999 the Environment Court found there was a clear case for differentiating the Wakatipu Basin in 19, from the other O&Ls. Well, put briefly, what's changed that's caused you to come, you and your colleagues, to come to a different opinion?
In Dr. Reid's view, it's not so much. Dr. Reid's view, the landscape isn't the O&L Wakatipu Basin landscape and the O&L District Y are not that different. The O&L District Y policies are a response to development pressure.